Can. Fifth chapter of the book of Matthew is where we'll start today. If you're following along in an actual paper Bible or an iDevice or some type, go ahead. I'll, of course, have most of the scriptures I reference up on the overhead along with some other information. But fifth chapter of the book of Matthew is where we start. Before we do that, I want to tell you about Harry's newest habit. Told you last week he started talking about himself in the third person. If you were here on Sunday night, you know, Laura asked me if I wanted some ice cream from the kitchen, and you hear a yell from his bedroom, Harry wants some ice cream too. So that's kind of one of his habits. This week he's arguing with the television. We're those kind of people that if we're home, the television's on. It may be on a news channel if there's something going on. It may be on the History Channel because I like a lot of that. Yesterday it was on Andy Griffith reruns all day. I think it was the Sundance Channel. Had a lot of good season ones when they had the new lady druggist and they were trying to get Andy paired up with her and everything like that. But, you know, Harry picks up a lot from commercials and he started arguing with them a little bit more often. He's your typical little boy. He loves Happy Meals from McDonald's, but if you tell him, well, I don't want a McDonald's, I want to go to Sonic, he's fine with a Wacky Pack. So he's okay with that. But if we're at home on a Saturday or something and we're not bringing something home from Fort Smith, if we say we're going to go into Greenwood, Harry wants something else. He wants us to stop at Arby's. Now, Harry doesn't have an affinity for roast beef or anything like that. He just likes curly fries. And I get that because I like curly fries too. I would be lying if I said I've never got a burger from one place and curly fries and a Jamocha shake from Arby's. Well, anyway, if I were to poll the audience this morning, I'm not going to do so, but if I went out there and asked, what is Arby's current marketing slogan? I think most of you would probably know it, right? Arby's, we have the meats. Now, I said that wrong. I guess I say it real loud. Arby's, we have the meats, or however that guy does it. So Harry's sitting there, he's playing with his Legos, and Arby's comes on selling brown sugar bacon sandwiches or whatever their flavor of the month is, and the guy says, Arby's, we have the meats, and Harry pops up and says, no, you don't, Arby's. You have the curly fries. He doesn't want the meats. He wants the curly fries from Arby's. I think when I get a little older, I'm going to have to publish a book of all these, and fortunately, I've got them all jotted down on my notes. I might be able to retire early selling that book. That's something to think about. All right, verse 13, Matthew 5 is where we'll start this morning. Maybe. Well, I'll turn it on. Let me try it again. There it comes. All right, Lowell. It just was sleeping for a minute. Matthew 5, beginning in verse 13. This is Jesus talking. He says, you are the salt of the earth, but if the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot. You are the light of the world. A town built on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand and it gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven. Evangelism is what this is talking about, right? This is talking about how we do what we're told to do and get out into the world and spread the message as God has wanted us to do. It's got the Sermon on the Mount, we've got the Beatitudes, and you know that's really kind of a good way to sum that up. With these words, when they're at work in our lives, we become evangelistic. We become the salt, we become the light, just as we're told to. Another way of putting that is the word influence. As Christians, we have influence on others that changes lives. I asked my good friend Webster. Webster knows more words and the definitions more than I will ever be able to learn. And he's got that influence and that funny way you pronounce it up there. But it's defined as the capacity to have an effect on the character, development, or behavior of someone or something, or the effect itself. If you look at a different definition, and this one is kind of the one I'm looking at today, influence is also the act, process, or power of producing an effect without any apparent force or direct authority. I get what that means. You know, I supervise people at work, and if I want them to get something done, I can usually tell them, hey, this is what I need you to get done. But if we've got a day, say, for example, we're a call center, a sales call center. So if we look at the numbers and it doesn't look like we've been very busy that morning, I could probably just tell them, hey, You need to make some more phone calls. But usually when I send out a report, as I do so often, and it shows that it's low, a lot of them look at that and they can take that on their own. Okay, we need to get busy. We need to get going. Kind of the same thing. We all have influence, don't we? What Jesus is telling about us here in Matthew 5. You know, salt, as we mentioned, it makes its presence known. You ever ate something with too much salt? You ever get that shaker and give it a couple of shakes and the lid falls off? And now you've ruined it, haven't you? Yeah, a little bit of it goes a long way. By the same contrast, if something needs salt, you're going to notice it, right? It's going to be something you're going to pick up. You know, there's other scriptures that affirm the point that this is making. We saw back in there, a city on a hill cannot be hidden. A lit candle gives light to all in the house. The question that I'm talking about today is not whether or not we have influence, because we all do, whether it's good or bad. That's the question, whether that influence, and what is it doing in the world today? Sociology is the study of the development and structure and function of human society. It's people that look at the habits we form and the things we've done over the years, and they just figure us out a little bit. They kind of figure out why we do the things we do as humans walking around on this earth. And those people that have studied our behavior for years and years, they say that there is a minimum number of people that each one of us will influence in a lifetime. What do you suppose that number is? Is it 1,000? I don't think 1,000's enough. I mean, if you think of growing up in a mid-sized school, you know, I grew up, went to Greenwood, a pretty good-sized school. There's schools around here that are smaller, but think about that. I think about church. I think about the jobs I've had. I think, sure enough, I've probably hit 1,000 people by the time I got to age 30. That sounds about right. So is it 5,000? That sounds better, but it's not close enough either. The number is 10,000. Sociologists say that each one of us will most likely have some influence, whether it's a great influence or a small influence, on 10,000 people over the course of our lives. Those same smart people have another question. And that question is, how long will our influence be felt by others? How long do you think, whether we've given someone just a little bit of influence or whether we've made a big impact on their lives, how many years would that be? Would you say it's 80? It might be a decent example. 80 is the kind of the rough average. I'm sure the average lifespan is 80-something point something at this point. I don't know what it is. I don't study it that well. But, you know, 80 years is kind of a rough average lifespan. But I think that's a little too short. I mean, when people leave us, when people depart from this earth, they suddenly don't stop influencing us. That carries on, right? So how about 100 years? Some folks live to be 100. That might be it. Those sociologists, they're claim to be smarter. They say that our influence will be felt for 150 years. I don't think that means 150 years after we're gone. No, don't take it that way. But, you know, 150 doesn't sound as far-fetched as you think. If you look at two of my great-grandmothers, my mom's dad's mom and my dad's dad's mom, I'll let you roll with that for just a minute. They were both great-grandmothers to me. They were both born before the year 1900. If they were with us today, one would be turning 118 and the other one would be turning 129, believe it or not. I can remember stories about them. I can remember some things about them, some just a very little bit. But I also remember the things that my parents and my grandparents told me about them. Again, a little bit of it I remember firsthand. But if I pass that along to Harry, if I tell him about his great-great-grandmothers, he's going to remember that. Maybe he'll pass that on to his kids one day. You can see we're getting 150 isn't so far-fetched when you start thinking about things like this. 10,000 people and for 150 years. It's clear that the lives we live on this earth can have an influence on other people. It's also clear that folks throughout our Bibles influenced others and changed lives, didn't they? If we go all the way back to Genesis, would you say that Eve had an influence over Adam and what became their life? I think we'd probably agree with that. The children of Israel influenced Aaron to build a golden calf, and that had, shall we say, less than desirable results. The spies sent to explore Canaan exerted their influence, and there was wandering and a whole lot of stuff that doesn't sound like fun to me. Think about Pilate. I think Pilate's a crystal clear example of this. Did Pilate allow others to influence him? Absolutely. Pilate allows the Jews to influence him. And of course, we had the result of the crucifixion of Jesus. I could go on, but I think we've established well that there are many people in our Bibles that have had great and small influences over a great number or many of things. Again, we will have an influence. It's going to happen, whether you want to or not. Whether you like the idea of someone, maybe it's looking up to you or being a role model or even just taking something away from you, it's going to happen. And the question is, what kind of influence will we have? If it's bad, we can change it. But with our influence, as powerful as we can be, or as powerful as it can be made, rather, will we be the salt of the earth and the light of the earth, as we're talking about in Matthew 5? Or will that influence push people in the wrong direction? That's kind of what I'm thinking about this morning. You know, back to salt. I love the fact that it talks about salt. I like salt. I just do. I'm one of those guys that I usually put salt. I don't ever touch that pepper shaker. You can keep the pepper shaker. I went to Walmart the other day because we moved into a new building and I lost my salt shaker that I keep at my desk for when I need a little salt on my lunch. I wanted to get a new salt shaker and I had to buy a pepper shaker with it. Okay. I have a pepper shaker. If you need one, let me know. It's one of those little cardboard ones. I'll bring it to you. I don't got a use for it. I just like the salt. But salt is distinctive. A little bit of it goes a long way. It enhances very well what it touches. If it's present, it's easily recognizable. If it's absent, or at least I do, I easily miss it if it's absent. But salt isn't neutral, is it? Rarely do you get the salt shaker and you get it going over there. You give it a generous 8 or 9 shakes, which is probably too many according to my doctor. You taste it and it's not there, right? It's not neutral. And the same goes for us in our walk as Christians. If we're living out Jesus' message here in Matthew 5, we're not neutral either. When we are the salt of the earth in our lives, whether it be at our homes, whether it be here at this church, whether it be at school, or whether it be at our jobs, it should be noticed. It should be noticed by people around us, and it should be felt by people around us when we are absent, when we are not there. Now, I mentioned I use the salt shaker very liberally. But I do one thing generally before I salt my food. You take a bite of it, right? You never know if somebody's already put too much salt in it. The lone exception is the baked potato. They always ask me, "You want to make your baked potato loaded?" No, I just want butter and sour cream. I'm a plain kind of guy. You bring it to me plain and sour cream, I'll salt it and it'll be delicious. How long does it take you to realize when you're eating a meal if it needs salt? If you're eating, my favorite meal is just good old chicken fried steak and mashed potatoes. You just can't beat it. I'm sure you can't tell that from me standing up here this morning. But if I'm eating a chicken fried steak and mashed potatoes, do I get halfway through the chicken fried steak? Do I get 4 or 5 bites in the mashed potatoes and then, something's missing and I just can't put my finger on it? No. It takes one bite, doesn't it? It takes one bite of whatever it is for you to go reaching for that salt shaker if you need it. You know, we've been talking about our upcoming Children's Night a little bit coming up in here in August. I'm certainly looking forward to it. And I'm going to tell you right now, I'm not going to complain a single bit if every tub, every scoop, or every spoonful of ice cream down there came from Walmart or CVs or Harps. Won't complain a bit. That being said, I know some of y'all have got ice cream makers. And I would love it if you would put those ice cream makers to use. There's nothing better than homemade, right? Homemade ice cream has a better taste. Again, I'm not discriminatory. Like Bruce, I like my Blue Bell, but I'm not going to turn down Blue Bunny either. But I just hopefully somebody or somebody's make up homemade, whatever flavor you want to make. I guarantee you, if you make homemade ice cream, whatever flavor it is, I'll try at least a spoonful. It just tastes better to me. I don't know why it is. Maybe it's because of, you know, anytime I'm trying to guilt trip Laura into making me a sandwich or something late at night, I tell him her always tastes better when she makes it because she makes it with love. And Laura rolls her eyes and either fixes me a bologna sandwich or tells me to go do it myself, one of the two. Maybe that's why homemade ice cream tastes better. I don't know. But the process is fascinating too. You know, I've seen those old hand crank ice cream makers. In fact, you know, everybody's got the electric motor one now that works. That's fine, but you know, it's got to have time to make, doesn't it? It's not something you can't, if you're planning on coming down here at 7 o'clock on a night and you think it's 6:30, oh, you know, I ought to make some homemade ice cream. Well, it's probably going to be too late at that point. But, you know, you get your ingredients mixed in, you put it in the canister, you put in ice around it. Before you start, what else do you put in it? You put salt. You put that rock salt. 7-year-old me thought he would get a taste of that rock salt once. Never guilty of doing that again. But your little ice cream makers, you've got the rock salt and you've got the ice. All of that's very critical to the process, right? It's not going to work if you don't put that in there. But all those little ice cream makers have got that hole in the side. Why? Because that ice is going to melt. It's going to mix with the salt. It's going to make salt water. And you want that away from the ice cream, don't you? You want that to drain off. That's why it's there. If you get a little buildup of that, it'll bleed off out the side, because that salt that is so critical or important to the process of making your ice cream will also ruin it if it gets in there, won't it? Yeah. Salt is both critically important, but it can also ruin things. As children of God, we are to be like salt. That's why this comparison is being made in Matthew 5. We are in the world, though not of the world. We are to be His chosen people. We are to be a peculiar people, and we are to be distinctly different. Evangelism, by the standard provided for us in the New Testament, isn't just a name on the sign outside. It's not just the absence of a piano or other instruments here like we do. It's not the way our congregation is set up with elders. That's not the definition of evangelism. Evangelism is defined by each of us having the right heart, having the right mind, and having the right attitude. And that is, of course, the hard-minded attitude of Jesus. The kids might learn something today. Kids these days don't realize what salt was used for back in the day. They don't remember the days of salting meat and vegetables to preserve them. Refrigeration's taking care of that for us. Refrigerated trucks, refrigerators. Well, I can't spit that out. In the house, I mean, everything like that. Think about what our world would be like today if we removed all the salt. And by that I mean if we removed all of the influence for good. Just like we talked about of it, a little bit of it goes a very long way. Think about Noah. Noah's righteousness, his blamelessness, his faithfulness, his good influence didn't save the human race, but it did save his family, didn't it? Think about how many people it would have taken to save Sodom and Gomorrah. 50 people. Well, no, 45. No, 40, then 30, then 20, and finally they got all the way down to 10. I'm guesstimating numbers today, maybe 10%, maybe a little more of the people we have here today. Just that amount of good people would have saved Sodom and Gomorrah. It just takes a little bit to do a whole lot of good. We have a duty. We have a duty as Christians, as followers of Christ, to do what we can to stop the evil that's around us in the world, and we know it's there. We are to be just that little bit of salt that is needed in the world today. We talked about the definition of evangelism, and you know, our location isn't what makes us evangelistic. Our location here in Dayton doesn't make us evangelistic. The building around us that we've been graciously blessed with, it doesn't make us evangelistic. Again, it's the Christ-like nature in each and every one of our hearts that makes us evangelistic. Continuing to talk about salt, another aspect of it that's interesting is that salt loses itself as it does its job, doesn't it? Think about that for a minute. Salt, as it's, whether it's making your baked potato better, whether it's freezing up that ice cream, or whatever it is you've got salt doing, by the time you get done, there's none left over, is there? It's pretty well gone. It expends itself. It blends in. Whether it's making something taste different, preserving something with it, purifying with it, it loses itself for the purpose that it serves. And there's two verses I want to look at that kind of tell us a similar story, help with this point. Matthew 10 and verse 38 says, "Whoever does not take up their cross and follow me is not worthy of me. Whoever finds their life will lose it, and whoever loses their life for my sake will find it." I hope that makes the concept a little bit clearer, but that's what I'm talking about. When we're becoming the salt of the earth, when we are becoming evangelistic as God wants us to be, we lose ourselves to that, don't we? We get the ability, and we need to have the ability, to get past our own wants and our own desires and lose ourselves in the act of serving others. John 12 and 24 is another one that brings this point home. It says, "Very truly I tell you, unless a kernel of wheat falls to the ground and dies, it remains only a single seed. But if it dies, it produces many seeds." That's what we have to do. Die to self and take on the nature of Jesus. We have to ensure that we are salting in the world. We have to ensure we're getting past ourselves and getting out to people. Jesus also told us that salt can become useless. This is back to what we discussed in Matthew 5. This is verse 13. It says, "You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot." Salt can become ineffective. It can get mixed with other stuff, polluted with other stuff. And I mean, if you spilled a bunch of salt in the dirt, are you going to scoop up that dirt and try to get salt out of it so you could use it? There's plenty of salt around. We don't have a shortage of it. Not that I'm aware of. You're probably just going to throw it out and get some more. There's nothing left to do with polluted salt but throw it out. That can happen to us today. We can pollute the influence we have to the point it's not useful for good anymore. It isn't useful for God's purposes. The Pharisees of Jesus' time had done exactly that. Matthew 23 and verse 15 says, "Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You travel over land and sea to win a single convert, and when you have succeeded, you make them twice as much a child of hell as you are." The church at Laodicea is another example. They had become lukewarm. You could say they had polluted themselves as well. A church, or better said, a Christian, who's polluted their influence, whose influence is no longer good, it's just not right. It's a contradiction of terms. It's like having salt that has no taste. Without an influence of good, without an influence for things that are right or for things that are righteousness, we limit our usefulness. We degrade our usefulness. We have to maintain what sets us apart from the world so we can be useful, so we can be effective in everything that we do. Salt is distinctive. It's a preservative. It loses itself as it works, and it becomes ineffective when contaminated. But bearing in mind all of that, salt is only useful if it's, for lack of a better word, out of the shaker. Wouldn't you agree? If you've got a salt shaker full of salt and you keep it up on the top shelf of whatever next to the thyme and all those other things and you never get it out and use it, it's not going to do you any good. For salt to do whatever you want it to do, it's got to come into contact with something else. It's got to do another job. It's got to come into contact. If we're doing it right, we're the same way. If we are becoming the salt of the earth, will change what we come into contact with. Whether we're living our lives the way that God has told us, whether we're putting ourselves out there and taking a challenge or taking a risk, becoming the salt of the earth means that we come into contact with people and they leave changed because of it. We have to keep that saltiness. We have to ensure that we live our lives in a way that makes difference in the world, makes a difference in the world. I want to move from salt to light from our same passage in Matthew 5. We're told to be the light of the world. And first thing I want to point out that light does a couple of things. Light penetrates. Light illuminates. I mean, we've got plenty of lights on up here today, don't we? We've got lots of bulbs over here. We've got some of these can lights up here. I mean, there's lots of them. Even if we didn't have lights, we've got these windows. I mean, if we turned them all off, don't worry, I'm not about to, we'd still be able to see, right? We've got plenty of light for us to see with. Now, if we turned all the lights off, if we waited till about 2 in the morning, then it'd be getting dark, wouldn't it? It'd be pretty dark in here about then. Maybe we'd, I don't know if it'd be completely dark. I know they've got those mercury vapor lights around the place. Maybe there's some of those. Maybe the moon's shining bright tonight, you know, all of those things. Let's say the lights are off. It's 2 a.m. There's no security lights. There's no moon in the sky. It's dark enough you can't even see your hand in front of your face. Okay, think about that. What if we lit a candle? Would the fact that this room was as pitch dark as it could be make that candle any less effective? No. The candle's still going to do as good a job. Now, a candle's probably not going to be as effective with all the lights on in the room, but no matter how dark the room gets, the candle still penetrates. It still illuminates. No matter how dark the room, a candle's light will penetrate the darkness. And that's important because our influence as Christians is exactly the same. We have the power to penetrate the darkest heart. We have the power to touch people in more ways than we can even realize. letting our light shine, letting Jesus shine through us, has an impact upon others more than we can ever know. And I'd even go so far to say that living out the gospel can sometimes be more powerful than the message preached from this pulpit. What I mean by that is that I'm sure we've all known good folks in the church, teachers, preachers, deacons, elders. They may have sat on pews for years and heard sermon after sermon, never obeying the gospel. But instead something else influenced them. A family member, a friend, a faithful spouse. They began to see the Word of God in the way this person lived their life. They began to consider the gospel message that they'd heard and hadn't responded to over the years. They came to believe in Jesus, in His crucifixion, and in His resurrection. All because someone who loves them lived their life in a manner that we're being told to here in Matthew 5. That influence can illuminate the heart to the truth. That illumination can result in obedience. I think most of us today would agree that we are the people we are today because of the influence of others. Do you agree with that? I've often said from this very place that everybody in life teaches us something. Some people teach us what to do. Some people teach us what not to do. There's a passage from 1 Peter 3, beginning right there in verse 1, that I want to read. It says, "Wives, in the same way, submit yourselves to your own husbands, so that if any of them do not believe the word, they may be won over without words by the behavior of their wives when they see the purity and reverence of your lives. Your beauty should not come from outward adornment, such as elaborate hairstyles and the wearing of gold jewelry or fine clothes. Rather, it should be that of your inner self, the unfading beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is of great worth in God's sight." I think that means exactly the point we're trying to communicate this morning. A godly influence is a powerful thing, and it's so powerful it can serve to lead others to Christ. Another thing to think about with our lights is the way the passage is worded. It says, "Let our light shine." It doesn't say shine our lights, does it? When you say shine our lights, that makes me think of Harry with a flashlight, because Harry loves to point that flashlight right about here. Shine those lights. Get them. It says, "Let our light shine." And I think there's a distinct difference between the two. The Pharisees of Jesus' time loved to get that flashlight out and shine it right in people's eyes, didn't they? They loved to pray on the street corners. They wanted to be seen praying. They wanted everybody to notice what they were doing. They loved the chief seats in the synagogue. They wanted to be seen and heard right down up front in front of everybody. They gave generously to the poor, not because they were touched by their suffering, because they wanted people to see them doing it. That's the difference we have to look at today, is that we need to let our light shine, not so much that we are the light, but that Jesus is the light. And we are merely reflectors of Him, of that light. I've told you before of my career aspirations when I was a kid. I remember in junior high, they were all wanting us all career orientation. You got to start figuring out then what you want to do in your life, because 7th and 8th graders are in a prime position to figure out what they want to do with their life. That was a joke. It was a little bit of sarcasm. But you know what I wrote down on that sheet when they asked me what I wanted to be? I wanted to be an astronaut. I wanted to fly the space shuttle. I wanted to fly it to the moon. I didn't realize that the space shuttle didn't stop at the moon at that point, but you kind of see the point. The moon still fascinates me. I think we need to send people back. I can think of several people off the top of my head that I would love to be on the first flight back. That was me, and I apologize. I hope Harry can one day go to the moon. I think it's just a terrible thing that there are literally 12 men who have ever lived, most of which who aren't still alive, that have ever been to and walked on the moon. I love to look at it. I love seeing it big and bright in the night sky. But that's really kind of the thing you have to think about it. The only reason we see the moon in the night sky is because of the sun, isn't it? The moon doesn't illuminate itself and send it back here. The sun's light gets on the moon and we see it reflected back to us. If the sun wasn't shining on the moon, it wouldn't be lit up for me to see up there and dream about. Jesus is like the sun. We're kind of like the moon. As children of God, we are to reflect His heart, His attitude, His disposition, the way He lived His life. We are to be like Paul. We are to allow others to see Jesus living in us. That's really what I hope we can all remember this morning, is That's what evangelism is. Real evangelism, as God wants us to do, is just becoming the salt and light of the world. I don't want to make it sound easy because it's not, but that's what it is. It's in our daily lives. It's as we go about our jobs, whether we're in an office somewhere, or on a job site, or in a classroom. It doesn't matter where it is. It's living our lives as God has commanded us to do and letting others see Him through us. Each moment of our day influences others. It's up to us whether that's a positive or a negative impact. I just hope that God helps me. I hope God helps all of us to live our lives as He would want us to live them. If you've not obeyed the gospel this morning, we're going to offer this invitation. Upon confession of your faith, we'll baptize you for remission of your sins. God's got a plan for you today. He's got a plan for each and every one of us. If you've not obeyed the gospel today, there's no telling whose influence He's using to get to you. He wants you to obey the gospel. He wants you to become His child. He wants you to join Him in heaven one day. Maybe you're in need of prayer. If there's any way we can help you this morning, please come while we stand and while we sing.